I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. In the life of the Great Republic, we have reached a strange interlude, a hinge of American power in the world and in Washington. Maybe the strangest thing about the Trump transition is that the wisest heads have no shared idea which way history is moving. Two unorthodox military professionals, Andrew Bacevich and Larry Wilkerson, lead our quest this hour for the pattern in the president-elect's first key appointments and a leading figure in what calls itself the realist school of foreign policy. Steve Walt is going to chart Donald Trump's intentions on a global map. But first, we're remembering a few of the innumerable things that the scorned candidate said, campaigning against the policy networks of both parties before he beat them. This was his first teleprompter speech back in April, which lots of us barely noticed till it was reposted this week.
Our goal is peace and prosperity, not war and destruction. The best way to achieve those goals is through a disciplined, deliberate, and consistent foreign policy. With President Obama and Secretary Clinton, we've had the exact opposite, a reckless, rudderless, and aimless foreign policy, one that has blazed a path of destruction in its wake. After losing thousands of lives and spending trillions of dollars, we are in far worse shape in the Middle East than ever, ever, ever before. It has been a complete and total disaster. We have to look to new people because many of the old people, frankly, don't know what they're doing, even though they may look awfully good writing in the New York Times or being watched on television. I will work with our allies to reinvigorate Western values and institutions instead of trying to spread universal values that not everybody shares or wants. We should understand that strengthening and promoting Western civilization and its accomplishments will do more to inspire positive reforms around the world than military interventions.
A lot of people will ask whether that man knew what he was reading or meant what he said. Our guest, Lawrence Wilkerson, is a retired U.S. Army colonel who served as chief of staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell in the second Bush administration. He has said that he and his boss were both duped in the promotion of the Iraq War by a Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld cabal. So, Larry Wilkerson, you're our inside witness on how power works at the top of the security state. Can you read the Trump transition for us? And I'd love you to start with your seminars at William & Mary.
You know, I've got to start with what you just played. That could have been George Kennan writing the long telegram from Moscow at the incipient portion of the Cold War. That could have been the X article, talking about how we don't need so much brutal power in the world as we do the power of our example. And that example ought to be enough to light a candle for the rest of the world. That was an extraordinary rehearsal of what Kennan had written so many years ago about the best way to confront the Soviet Union. But yes, concluding the seminar recently at William & Mary with my students, who had looked at, in 13 three-hour seminars each, previously every president since World War II, from Harry Truman to Barack Obama, we decided to look at a hypothetical Trump team. Only some of it was not hypothetical. Pence and Trump, of course, Bannon and a few others, Flynn as the National Security Advisor. But we threw some people in, Mattis, Giuliani, and Romney and others, into potential positions like Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and so forth. And
Petraeus, I'm sure.
Petraeus. And it was, and my students actually threw David in, and it was the liveliest seminar I've had in 11 years on two campuses with this particular curriculum. It was incredible. I almost had students, to the point of coming out of their seats.
What impresses the students? Read their minds.
Yeah, I think mostly they finally realized that they had come to this end of presidents, if you will, in the post-World War II era, where we had become the new Rome in 1945 with awesome power. They had finally come to a point where it was almost inexplicable how we were going to deal with that power, such as it is, from this point on. And it was going to involve their lives, not mine. They know I'll be in the grave in 10 or 15 years. It was going to be their lives. Their lives get wrapped up in such challenges as whether or not we meet climate change, whether or not we are overwhelmed by China as it becomes the number one economy in the world, whether or not we bleed ourselves away in the Middle East on the periphery of our empire. These are questions that they've been building all throughout the semester, but that Donald Trump and his team, such as it is, have brought to a crescendo of questions, if you will, in their minds.
Well, there are questions that everybody senses, but almost nobody mentions. I wonder which Donald Trump do they believe, the president with a staff of generals, or the president who says, hold it, this is a breakpoint in 30, 40 years of bad policy?
Well, that was part of their questioning. Who is this man? And who is this man, particularly when they have studied presidents throughout the post-World War II era and learned that perhaps the greatest harm is done initially, in particular, by those with little experience. President Obama being a case in point, George W. Bush being another case in point, and then realizing that this particular gentleman has absolutely no experience at this level of power management whatsoever. So that's a frightening thing. So immediately they went to their second source of good decision-making or bad decision-making, and that is the team that the individual chooses to assemble around himself. We've all the presidents have been male to this point. So when they did that and they started talking about Flynn and a potential Giuliani and a potential Romney and a potential Mattis at defense and so forth, I think their incredulity and their lack of ability to say anything positive increased astronomically. And their concern and their fright increased astronomically. There were a couple of students in the seminar who started it out clearly as being in the minority. In other words, they were either for Trump or they were at least willing to give him a chance. By the time we finished the seminar, some 3 hours later, almost everyone was looking at me with the same kind of question marks in their faces that all were in the beginning and carried throughout the seminar. No one knows what this is going to produce. And for people who are looking at their productive years, looking at the time when they're going to have families, when they're going to have children and so forth, and being in such a quandary about what that future is going to be like, I feel for them. I truly do. I'm checking out. I mean, I screwed this world up. My generation screwed this world up pretty badly. We talked about things like there's $162,000 worth of debt on their shoulders already, and it's growing every day. We looked at the clock on the Internet that the Congress keeps posting, where the clock just keeps turning over and turning over and turning over in terms of national debt, in terms of debt on their shoulders and so forth. They know all about debt.
Larry Wilkerson, I want to know, what do they know about exceptionalism? No. The rules don't apply to us. We can carry on, you know, with red ink and all sorts of losses forever.
Well, they've studied empire. I have one history PhD candidate in the seminar. He chimes in from time to time to let people know about the Roman Empire, the Assyrian Empire, the British Empire, all the empires throughout history who, incidentally, aren't here today, gone, not a single one of them here today, all gone. And then the question arises, where's the American empire heading? And for those who don't think we're an empire, my students will disabuse them of that really quickly.
And where do they think it's going, the imperial fortune?
I don't think they know. I think they're very concerned, though. They're very concerned that it's losing its power, and it's losing its power not so much because of others' power increasing in the world, though that is happening clearly, and they understand that, but because we are frittering away our power in what are enterprises of great pith and moment, but not with much to do with our national security.
Focus.
Resonated with me with what you were playing that Trump said. He's absolutely right, but of course that's just one picture of what he said. He said so many things.
Go close up on the sociology, if you will, of this security state and the body language, the play among the would-be powerhouse generals. I heard a wonderful story about your guy, Colin Powell, when he was NSC commander, being reminded by the Joint Chiefs that you're three stars, Brother Powell.
Yeah,
we're
well,
four.
He was being reminded,
keep your place.
He was being reminded when he was National Security Advisor to Reagan that Admiral Crowell, to whom he was talking at the time, a four-star chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, outranked him in his military rank.
But so what do you see in the maneuvers here with Mike Flynn and Petraeus in or out and James Mattis? I mean, what's going on? What is the selection? How's his taste as a picker?
If you look at the inexperience of this team and you look at the temperament and the character and the personality of a person like Mike Flynn, who, for example, has said that Islam is really a camouflage for radicalism, for murder and mayhem, who is an Islamophobe by any other title, and you realize that he's going to be advising in what is possibly the closest position to the President of the United States with regard to national security, it's positively frightening. When you think about a man with a mind as fixed as his is, looking at Islam, for example, as he said, the number one threat to the United States, when there are other huge threats out there like China and climate change itself, for example, it's difficult to see how this man is going to take a president who's basically inexperienced and point him towards the right places and the right items and the right things in terms of making a decision, particularly a national security decision. In terms of staffing the president, which is his first job, and in terms of coordinating the interagency group in order to serve the president best, I don't see how it happens. I mean, I could see Mike Flynn going over to Jim Mattis and Jim Mattis telling him to get out of his face. Jim Mattis is four times the person Mike Flynn is. And let's just talk about the general.
Hold on. We're going to take a break, Larry Wilkerson, but don't forget that point. We'll come back to how people like Kissinger, Brzezinski, others have played that game. Coming up, the soldier scholar Andrew Bacevich on the Washington rules that bear down on new presidents and may have forced themselves on Donald Trump already. This is Open Source. On the matter of the Trump transition and what can look like the formation of a government of generals, our guest Andrew Bacevich has rare credentials. He was an Army officer from West Point who served in Vietnam and then the first Gulf War and lost his son and namesake in the Iraq War. Well before that family loss, Andy Bacevich had a profound change of heart about the military enterprise he'd been part of. He has written extensively about imperial overreach in books like America's War for the Greater Middle East and Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. Welcome back, Andy Bacevich. What are you seeing in this Trump transition?
Well, I think I could endorse everything that Larry Wilkerson just said. I am very troubled by the prominence of retired senior military officers in this new team. At some point, we'll stop talking about a Trump administration and perhaps start talking about a Trump junta. I think General Mattis, who we think will probably be defense secretary, is a very able person. But there are able civilians who could fill that office with distinction. And it seems to me that the founders were committed to the proposition that at the very top of our military establishment, we would have civilian leaders. And on General Flynn, I think Larry Wilkerson is exactly right. The additional quote we could add on Flynn is that he has said, you know, we are in a world war. And that suggests that the kind of advice he's going to render to President Trump is going to be to bear down, to expand, to try harder. And again, Larry Wilkerson is exactly right. Part of the issue here is that the most critical and pressing issues that confront the United States in terms of providing for the well-being of our people and indeed for the well-being of the planet, the most critical issues are not in the Islamic world. They are in Asia. They do relate to things like climate change. And to the extent that we just double down on a series of misguided and unsuccessful military interventions, well, that doesn't look like very good news.
When I hear Army guys like you both talk about with this kind of close to rage about the military establishment, I always wonder, is this the sound of the barracks still? I mean, does this doubt pervade the forces?
Well, I would not claim to have enough contact with the active force to know what people, you know, talk about in the company orderly room. But what I would say is this, you know, in my day, which is in the military, which is actually quite a long time ago now, we understood that the principal purpose of American military power was to avert war, to manifest strength and resolve so that war would not occur. Over the past 20 years or so, we've moved into an era in which we think the purpose of military strength is to use it, to expend it, notwithstanding the fact that there is zero evidence that our exertions in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya have had even the slightest positive effect.
That sounds like the other Trump, the campaign Trump, a rare case of an American presidential finalist saying the generals don't know what they're doing. And Hillary had no very powerful comeback. You went further this week in a fierce piece online, Andy, saying not only they don't know what they're doing, it's time to retire en masse the 3- and 4-star generals. Bye-bye. Clean them out of the Pentagon. Does Trump have a residual memory of that spirit? What's happened to it?
Well, my suggestion was only slightly tongue-in-cheek. My real point is that the methods that we have in effect for selecting and educating those officers who will hold the 3- and 4-star ranks are manifestly inadequate. And so we need to rethink how these people are chosen and how they are how we nurture them. And you know, on Trump and his attitudes, we've got two things. We've got Trump, the candidate, who said that the generals really don't know what they're doing. They don't get the job done. I know more than the generals know. And then we've got Trump as president-elect, who is hiring the generals and seems smitten by generals whenever he has a meeting with one of them. So which is the real Trump? Difficult to say. But of course, that's only one example of how difficult it is for us at this juncture to know which is the real Trump, because he is the master of inconsistency.
He does fall in love easily. Let's note that. Even with Barack Obama, it was a love fest apparently at the White House. Larry Wilkerson, which is the real one? How can you guess? What would the clues be?
I have no idea, and that's part of the fear. That's part of my students' fear, too. We don't know who he is. We have a rhetoric that's been all over the map from one end to the other. So it's very difficult to pick out who he is, but we've studied each of these decision-making teams in detail from 1945 forward. And I will tell you that the picks of the team that will surround the commander-in-chief are very important. And that's how we have been trying to evaluate it from Bannon to Flynn. Looking at who he's picking, looking at what they might advise him to do, looking at what his inexperience might cause him to follow in that advice. And it's very frightening because we don't see a team being composed around him that looks like it's going to be very good. It's as inexperienced in many respects as he is. And, you know, you can take Doris Kearns Goodwin's team of rivals and you can say, oh, that's magnificent. It's wonderful. But you forget it takes a Lincoln to keep that team together and to keep it from being inimical to the interests of the country. And I don't see Trump as a Lincoln.
Meantime, we don't know who wrote that April speech of his. It wasn't Donald Trump. It sounds like Steve Bannon. Sounds even more like Pat Buchanan, a wise elder now, served interestingly in the Nixon and Reagan teams.
Well, but we don't know who the real Trump is. But the in that clip that you played, I mean, the most telling aspect of that was his advocating America as the exemplar, that the way we can be most influential in a positive way is by demonstrating that liberal values and democratic values.
He did say Western and Christian values.
I probably wouldn't go that far, but nonetheless, that serving as an exemplar is a more effective way of getting things done than simply being an imperial interventionist military power squandering our military everywhere. But is that the real Trump? Now, if it is, and notwithstanding the fact that his advisors are, to put it kindly, a mixed bag, then Trump could, if he discovers a set of principles here, actually produce change in our attitude toward the rest of the world that could end up being positive. But we still fall back on that question, which is the real Trump?
Speak of your own experience in a wonderful book. I love all your books, Andy, but especially I'm thinking of Washington Rules, which outlined the underlying not only pressure groups, money, doctrine, assumptions about the way the world works, including whatever else, projection of American power in hundreds, close to 1,000 military bases over the world. There's not a spot on the earth that we're not watching, you know, with a gun in our hands. Speak of those pressures on this man. We know that Barack Obama, who said we don't do dumb wars, was quickly talked into extending the Iraq war further into Afghanistan. What happens to these guys? And is it happening already to Donald Trump?
Well, I think it happens. It's likely to happen again when we think about the people he's appointing. The Donald Trump who said, elect me president and I will drain the swamp. I will destroy the establishment. That was a line that appealed to many of the people who voted for him. But the Donald Trump who then appoints a retired 3-star as national security advisor and probably a retired 4-star as defense secretary and possibly a retired 4-star as secretary of state is putting the establishment at the very center of his administration. And there's nothing about people like Flynn or even General Mattis that suggests that they are willing to ask critical first-order questions about the American empire, about our military posture around the world, about our penchant for interventionism. You'd have to ask those questions if you were really going to begin to distance yourself from the Washington rules and to put a new set of rules in place.
So they sit him down and say, Mr. President, here are the rules. This is the way we do things, and this is what we're going to do next week and by the end of this year, by the end of your first term.
That's not the conversation. They don't have to say that. I mean, there is a status quo. There is a defense budget. There are roles and missions. There is a global presence. There are programs that take years to come to fruition, to which we commit tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars. In order to have change occur, you have to have somebody who is smart enough and gutsy enough to confront the representatives of the establishment and say, tell me why I shouldn't undo that, because my intention is to undo that. Here's a specific example. Obama approved a $1 trillion modernization program for our nuclear arsenal, a program that's going to take 3 decades to come to fruition.
So-called modernization.
Yeah, new nuclear weapons, new manned bombers, new missiles, new submarines, $1 trillion. If indeed his Trump's intention is to drain the swamp, well, that's a good place to start. That's a good place to start by saying, tell me why it is in the interests of the United States to spend $1 trillion on developing a new set of weapons that must never be used and have no real utility in a post-Cold War world. But I don't believe that Trump really has the moxie, the intelligence, to even pose that kind of a question. And he's not going to hear that question from General Mattis. He's not going to hear that question from General Flynn.
If he asked you, Larry Wilkerson, what would you tell him?
I agree with what Andrew just said. In fact, we talked about some of those matters, including the nuclear program, and I agree with Trump's inability just from the fact that he lacks the experience to deal with such esoteric issues. They're not esoteric to people like Andy and me or others who've been in the business, but they are to Donald Trump. He wouldn't know a standoff launch cruise missile with a nuclear warhead from the new Air Force multi-billion-dollar bomber.
I wouldn't either.
Remember, as a candidate, Trump was asked to a question that caused would require him to identify the nuclear triad, meaning a strike force that consists of manned bombers, land-based missiles, and submarine-launched missiles, and he was not able to identify the triad. That's the guy that we have coming into office, and that's the guy who, again, unless he undergoes an astonishingly rapid education, won't know enough to ask the questions that need to be asked.
Okay, I just want to say I'm one of those people who does not underestimate his intelligence. I mean, people raise serious, almost serious questions. Can this man read? Is that why he doesn't use a teleprompter? You know, does he know anything at all? He's a very clever guy, and he made mincemeat of the field. So starting from there, further question about Donald Trump. Maybe this is for you, Larry. Does he know how free he is? He campaigned saying, nobody knows nothing but me, only I can do it. And he owes, in terms of massive, you know, sectoral interests and contributions, he owes almost nobody. What if he wanted to listen, called you in as he called in the congresswoman who'd served in Iraq?
Tulsi Gabbard.
And said, give me the unshirted case.
Chris, let me tell you how I would look at this if I were trying to get some signals that this might be the case and therefore increase my optimism. If he fires about half of those whom he's already appointed, nullifies his vice president almost completely, makes him an anti-Cheney or a non-Cheney, if he gets rid of many of the people that we think he's going to appoint, and if he does appoint them, he then gets rid of them within 180 days or maybe six to 12 months, let's put it that way, then I'll begin to be a little more optimistic. If this is the guy who can fire people, then he's going to fire a lot of these people. Because if there's any inkling at all of his doing some of the things that you're intimating he might do, or that his intellect is capable of dealing with these kinds of people, he'll get rid of them. He'll get rid of them almost instantly because he'll realize he's done nothing but put the playbook in place.
Right.
He's put the Washington system in place.
I must say, I disagree with you, Chris. I don't think he has as much freedom of action as you suggest. It's true.
Well,
he has
as much as he wants to assert.
Well, I don't know.
Ronald Reagan said, I got elected, and now we're going to do it my way.
The people who elected him are expecting him to drain that swamp, to be anti-establishment. And if it turns out that he breaks that promise, and his early appointments suggest that he may, then the people who elected him will just as quickly turn on him. That's point number one. Point number two is this great big establishment that Trump supporters have declared to be the adversary is not simply going to lie down and go away. I mean,
look at what he's dealing with in terms of what Andy just described, the Republican Party, my party. Look at what he's dealing with. He's dealing with four parties. When Rince Priebus came on TV and wrapped his arms around Donald Trump's victory, that was a false move of all false moves.
Right.
The Republican Party is falling apart inside that embrace. He's got four different Republican parties he's going to have to deal with, let alone the Democratic minority.
He's got
John McCain and Lindsey Graham. He's got the Tea Partiers. He's got Mitch McConnell. He's got the people like Pence who are Israel firsters. This will fall apart immediately. If he stands back in glee and watches them fight themselves to suicide, that's fine. But how's he going to act without the parliament? How's he going to act without the legislature?
I also want to know, you know, he's got his base to think about, I suppose, if he thinks of bases. He's also got whoever it was that wrote that speech for him, that anti-interventionist line, which is a strong thread through the whole thing. I don't know Steve Bannon. I do know Pat Buchanan. I think he believes that stuff and would happily keep reminding him. Does that make a difference?
I hesitate to even to speculate on what it is that Donald Trump actually believes. That, I mean, does he have core convictions about America's role in the world? I don't know. A couple minutes ago, you made the point that, you know, sort of the last person he talks to, he's charmed by.
Yep.
And there's been some evidence of that. And is that the president we're going to have? That Mike Flynn comes in for a meeting at 1 o'clock and suggests the president do A, and then at 1:45 we've got you know, somebody else coming in with a different suggestion? And is this – is does he have an analytical mind? Is he able to evaluate relative courses of action as to which the costs involved in each, the prospects of success? He seems to be such a shoot-from-the-hip, say-whatever-comes-to-mind maybe that's not going to be his style. I hope it's not going to be his style. But everything we've seen so far says that that is his style.
I have to grant you, it's an incredibly mixed-up pudding of opinions and asides and old beliefs and whatnot that he threw at the voters. But I think there's a theme in it. We'll stick with the question. We're talking about the Trump transition. Coming up, a reorientation course in the wider world that's still out there. Notably, China, Islam, sea rise, and what could become a human flood of migrants looking for drinkable water and personal safety. This is Open Source. If Donald Trump, the campaigner, could sound almost radically anti-establishment, Stephen Walt at the Harvard Kennedy School is a once lonely, now widely quoted leader of the counter-establishment in the so-called realist school of international relations. Realist meaning think long-term power and interest. Don't do stupid stuff sort of thinking. Especially don't do things like the Iraq War that are going to look grossly overpriced and stupid in the longer run. I asked Steve Walt this week for a realist's reservations on Donald Trump.
The thing that worries me most, actually, both in terms of domestic politics, but also in terms of foreign policy, is he does appear to be someone with a long memory and a somewhat vindictive nature.
Yep.
He is not someone who takes a setback as evidence that maybe he made a mistake and should regroup.
The thin skin and the tweets, the vengefulness is one zone of Donald Trump. There's another side, there's something of the realist about him when it comes to declaring bankruptcy. No, New Jersey, Atlantic City, over, out of here, discount the debts and try something else. Even the settlement of the suits against Trump University, which could be considered the, you know, American foreign policy metaphor, pay it off, let's get out of here, try something else. Isn't this some sneaking appeal about a guy who knows when to declare bankruptcy?
I think that's right. And one could tell a story about Trump in foreign policy that looks pretty good, you know, 4 years from now.
Tell it. Give him the benefit of the doubt.
Well, he said two or three unproblematic things in the course of the campaign about foreign policy. One is that American foreign policy should first and foremost be about what's good for the United States. Second, we have lots of allies around the world, and they're not really pulling their weight. They're spending a lot less on defense, and they're relying upon American protection. And this is something that every American president since Eisenhower has complained about, because it's true. Now, how you deal with it is a separate question, but he was not wrong to point the finger to that. And then finally, he said, you know, these nation-building wars in places like Iraq or Syria or Libya, Afghanistan, they're stupid. They don't work. We don't win them. They cost a lot. They get us in trouble. They make people angry. This was a perfectly reasonable statement to people. If he'd stopped there, full stop, my foreign policy is about the American national interest, no more dumb wars, and getting allies to bear their fair share of collective burdens, I think people like me would not have found this objectionable. We would have found it, in fact, refreshing. Now, he unfortunately added a bunch of other things to that. You know, nuclear proliferation might be okay, not a real problem. We should maybe think about a trade war with China. suggesting he didn't really understand how international trade really worked. So there were some things in there that made people like me uncomfortable, plus the sort of xenophobia in there that, you know, Muslims are dangerous and we should maybe lock them up or we should register them. This is a recipe for an endless war against a religion of a billion people, make things worse. It's worth noting in this, it's a really fascinating thing about the whole Trump phenomenon. He runs against the Democratic foreign policy establishment and the Republican foreign policy establishment, and he beats them. He gets elected. His attack on the foreign policy establishment was part of a larger attack on a bunch of out-of-touch, East Coast, elite insiders who never hold themselves accountable, don't succeed, do things that ultimately harm America, and yet go blissfully on. So in a sense, he was leveling at the foreign policy establishment the same attack that Bernie Sanders was leveling at Wall Street.
Absolutely.
Right? And it resonated with a lot of people. And Hillary didn't have a good two-sentence answer for that.
There's a hinge here. And it feels like the biggest turn in my lifetime of something or other, a popular vote saying no, electing a president against the establishment, the way we've been doing things. There's something healthy about it and something very scary. I mean, describe the worst and then the hope.
The hope, which I don't really believe, but the hope would be that for a variety of different reasons, the American body politic had gotten trapped in a sort of dysfunctional moment or a dysfunctional epoch. We had this big empire, which we didn't know what to do with, and we couldn't find our way to get rid of it in a sensible fashion without getting dragged back into more trouble. We had allowed the professional politicians to sort of rig the system in a variety of ways through gerrymandering and other forms. We'd allowed money to pollute our politics in ways that had turned Washington into a place that couldn't get anything done. And therefore, somebody just had to come in and, you know, deliver some shock therapy, if you will.
That's the optimist.
That's my
optimist. Wild bet. Okay.
That's my optimist side of things. The negative version, and it's one that does actually worry me, is that Trump does not appear to be a person who thinks rules matter, at least not to him. He doesn't appear to be particularly familiar with the Constitution. He doesn't appear to have that much respect for it. He's all about winning. And winning is defined in narrow personal terms, right? He wants to win. Moreover, he has, as a number of his supporters, and I would include, you know, his strategic advisor, Steve Bannon, I think people who believe that there's one last moment now to sort of save their image of America, this image of a sort of white and law and order kind of America. I think it's a rather nostalgic image in various ways. And therefore, if this is the last chance to sort of save that, you do whatever it takes. And last but not least, Trump has shown himself to be a real gifted demagogic politician. There are ways in which authoritarianism could start creeping into our political system. And the next step is find a moment, find an emergency, find a terrorist incident, and say, you know, we're going to have to reimpose some surveillance. We're going to have to do a little bit more things we weren't doing before, or maybe even a little bit more of what we were doing before in order to keep Americans safe, right? And while we're at it, we need to register Muslims, and maybe we need to register some other people, too. People who subscribe to The Nation magazine, people who have donated money to the ACLU. Mm. Now, this all sounds completely out of a bad novel or a
bad
movie.
No, but it doesn't. It sounds like something out of our history. I mean, and we've had enemies this before. We've interned people before.
That's right.
We've seized upon events like 9/11 to militarize everything. It sounds like Cheney. It sounds like Nixon. It sounds like a lot of good and bad people that we've known all our lives. What's your specific kind of tripwire? What would say, aha, no, this is a no-no?
If we lose that capacity to hold the president accountable for his own mistakes, to hold his advisors accountable, then we're in real trouble. And the easiest way to do that is by sort of controlling information. What people like Putin and Erdogan have done very successfully to monopolize information, to sow, you know, be a fire hose when the other side is an eyedropper, so that people think the right things are being done because they don't know what the impact is. They don't know what the real results are. They have lost touch with what's really happening.
Hmm.
And they accept the president's guidance on all of this. As you say, we've seen this movie in other periods. I mean, the Bush administration did a great job of manipulating information to convince Americans that attacking Iraq was a good idea. Other tripwires, as far as I know, we've never really had a moment since Nixon where someone tried to use the intelligence services to go after political enemies. You know, Nixon did have FBI and CIA going after anti-war
Ellsberg and others.
Yeah, protesters in various ways. But our ability to conduct surveillance on people is much greater now. What the National Security Agency can do in terms of its technical capabilities is really extraordinary. As far as I know, that's never been turned on political opponents, right? Obama didn't tell the NSA to start tapping Mitch McConnell's cell phone to see if we could get any dirt on Mitch McConnell. Bush and Cheney did not tell the NSA, let's bug Nancy Pelosi, let's follow her online and see if we can find anything out that we could then go and tell her we'll expose.
But Nixon did send CIA tricksters into the Democratic headquarters, that was peanuts.
But that's retail compared to what's possible now. And so if we discover, you know, if it turned out that a Trump administration was starting to use those surveillance capabilities, some of the things, you know, established and created by the Patriot Act, not just to try and protect Americans from terrorists or other dangers, but in fact to play politics, to use that capacity to coerce, to intimidate, to silence. If you start seeing that kind of hardball being played, we're in a completely different planet.
That was the Harvard University realist in foreign policy, Steve Walt. Our guests, our colonels, are Andy Bacevich of many books, anti-empire books after his distinguished career in the U.S. Army, and Lawrence Wilkerson, who was chief of staff in the Colin Powell State Department. I'd love to look out for a moment and instead of in, Larry, starting with you on the real world out there, including the terrorist threat, China, global warming, you name it. What are the real objects of your attention and should be the president's?
Chris, let me say one thing first about what Steve said, just a short comment. The thing that really worries me in that regard, and I agree with just about every word Steve uttered, is the fact that we've now undone the possibility of restraining the U.S. armed forces in terms of domestic action. We now can use the armed forces of the United States for any domestic action that smacks of, quote, material support to terrorism, unquote. And I think about something like Standing Rock, what's happening at Standing Rock right now.
Interesting.
And I think about a president who just gets fed up, which Trump seems to have a marvelous capacity to do, and not being able to handle it with law enforcement and bringing the military into it. And then I think of that expanding into regional martial law and eventually national martial law. And I could see this happening. As Steve was talking, I was thinking about this. And at the same time, there are challenges out there confronting us, which you just referred to. They're far more important than what some of the things Trump's team, at least, and from time to time Trump himself, have seemed to emphasize.
Reorder the priority list. What's your priority list?
Well, my first priority in terms of standard threats looking us right in the face is China. China is trying to bury us, not war-wise. They don't want a war. I've dealt with Chinese leadership. I know the current ambassador, Shui Tin Kai. I know the current foreign minister, Wang Yi. I've sat across the table and talked with them. They don't want a war. What they want to do is bury us economically, financially. They want to bury us.
How?
That's the biggest threat we've got that's staring us in our face. If you want a bigger threat than that, an existential threat and a threat that threatens the entire globe, climate change. I spent 2 hours today on the phone with people all across the globe talking about what we did in Paris at COP21. And most scientists now, I belong to something called a Climate Security Working Group here in Washington. It's mostly DOD. And we are looking at scientific evidence that things are going a lot worse than we thought they were. The computer models have, in some cases, been wrong. Yes, but they've been wrong against us, not for us. The ice is melting faster. The temperature is rising faster. The sea is coming up faster, and so forth. The military is truly seized of this. I mean, we've got coastal installations that are going to have to spend tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars in order to preserve things like shipyards and airfields and ability to deploy.
Larry, let me ask, when will Donald Trump see the sea rising, you know, from the upper stories at Mar-a-Lago?
That's a good question. When will Jim Inhofe in the Senate realize that it's not a hoax and write books about it being a hoax? When will ExxonMobil quit contributing to his campaigns and so forth? When will
not to mention the Koch brothers.
Yeah, dumping tons of money into a campaign to refute all those scientists out there. And now you're looking at so few scientists that believe contrary to what I've just said that it's pitiful that the United States Congress in particular, but the American people in general and polls don't show more concern about these issues.
Hold it there, Larry. I want to ask Andy Bacevich for his reordered list of your batting order of crises, real threats, phony threats.
No, again, I agree with Larry. I think the only point of disagreement, and he knows the Chinese leadership much, much, much better than I do, is I don't know we should frame the issue as one of they're trying to bury us and therefore we have to come up with a response. I would frame the issue as one in terms of, guess what, we are not today the sole superpower on this planet. There are multiple powers. China is one of them. And there is an urgent need for us to take the lead in creating a stable multipolar order so that we can all share the planet, maintain some reasonable stability, and then cooperate with one another in trying to address the genuinely existential threats such as climate change. Hmm. That's what needs to be done. And again, whether this president, this next president can even grasp that urgent priority very much remains to be seen.
Larry, most people haven't heard of the so-called One Belt, One Road project in China. It makes the Eisenhower Highway Program look like, you know, potholes or something as in the scope and the expense and the care and the range all across Asia of China's courtship of the rest of the world. What would that imply as a choice for us, especially on the line of a collaborative, non-military?
If I may, it seems to me
what it is is
the competition is not a military one. Let's say that Larry is right. They're trying to bury us. They're trying to bury us by outperforming us in the economic sphere.
Is that fair?
I don't know if it's fair or not, but that's what they're doing. Yeah. And it's on that field of competition that we need to meet them. And simply squandering our power by dropping bombs in Syria has the opposite effect.
I don't disagree with that, Chris. I do think that there is a certain aspect of the Politburo and any leadership that might come in this one's wake, particularly in the PLA and its influence on the Politburo, that sees it as a zero-sum game. And so in that sense, they see our power, economic, financial, and otherwise, diminishing as theirs rises. And there's some reality to that, I think. What they would really like to do is to do away with the transactional reserve capacity of our currency, whether that becomes a collaborative effort so that we have a basket of currencies or whatever replaces currency in the technological future, or whether it is domination by some Chinese-backed sovereign wealth fund or even the renminbi or the yuan, whatever, remains to be seen. But they see what kind of power that has given us post-World War II.
Meantime, I was just going to ask, in that same anti-interventionist speech in April, he said, ISIS, you're history, you're over. You know, day one, you're gone. What does that mean? How would you talk him out of it?
They're already gone for all practical purposes. They're beaten in terms of terrain holding. The Iraqis, the Turks, the Kurds, and others are wrapping that up now. We'll have an aftermath that's worse than the foremath.
It sounds as if we've got to learn how to
We've got to learn a new conversation and maybe ways to manage a significant loss of altitude in the world. Thank you, Andrew Bacevich, Larry Wilkerson, and Steve Walt. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Susan Coyne, and Becca DeGregorio. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our commander-in-chief. I'm Christopher Lighton. Join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source.